It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here. Good to see my friend, Captain Mike.
Good to see you, Sean. Let me tell you, it's smoking hot outside.
Yes.
Unbelievable. My truck thermometer yesterday said 104. And I thought, well, surely I'd ride down the road and it'd go down to 97 or 8 or something. No, it stayed on 104.
That's so. Because often you'll get to like in the parking lot here or whatever, but you're saying that even riding down the road, you're
riding on the interstate.
104. That's a challenge out there, you know, as it's been.
So what's the wildlife? How do they stand it? I don't know how.
They stay in the shade. I tell you, tell you what, our next guest can talk about what I see. He can talk about it from an expert, but, you know, I live amongst them, right, where I live. Yeah. So I come in and go in. The deer, they move at night, you know, or later in the afternoon. And during the day, the number of deer that I see, and, you know, we're in longleaf forest, but we have, you know, bottoms and draws that come through there that hold water, real shady, you know, in a low place, even with longleafs. And, I mean, like, no other time of year you can go those, and there are multiple deer. I'm talking about areas
next
that are,
to the creek.
Next to the creek, or just low spots we have that have hardwoods growing in them that's got the shade. And those areas, you know, you drive by them are many degrees cooler than the hillside right next to it. And that's where they are. I mean, they move in the evenings, but during the day, it's actually kind of funny because I could say, let's go right here. Look at the deer. I mean, they get to the point too. They look at me and go, I do not want to get out in that sun. I'm just going to lay here and pretend you're not even there so we can, we can stay here. So yeah, they're getting in the shade.
And you're fortunate. You have two creeks on your property that are cold, cool water creeks.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hot water or stagnant water.
Right. They're cool down.
Yeah. That's got to help the deer a little bit on your place.
Yeah. But, you know, and I don't see them. I mean, obviously see them there drinking or crossing or whatever, but it's these, you know, it's the areas around the creeks. And like I said, any kind of low areas I have, that shade makes a difference. And they take advantage of it. Speaking of which, I could sit here and jaw-jack about it, or we could bring on the deer program coordinator with the state of Alabama. Chris Cook joins us now to talk about several things. But, yeah, we can get started with that and actually talk about what's the science say on deer when it's 104 degrees, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, they seek out those areas that not only are shady, but, you know, there's places where air moves through better than other places. So they find those spots. It's just like those old dog trot houses, how the breeze comes down through the dog trot. And it's kind of the same thing out there in the woods. They find those places where the air's moving, combine that with some shade, and it makes it tolerable. But, you know, that's what they're there for, is to live in those kind of conditions. So they make do. But, yeah, they find those little nooks and crannies where it's a little bit better for them, with not just the temperatures, but maybe fewer horse flies and deer gnats and things like that, too. So that little bit of breeze can help with that, too.
Yeah, just a few. We might not notice it just like riding down the road here, but a few degrees when you live outside, it's worth doing.
That's right.
Yep. I'm sure it's 10 degrees difference in the shade, so that does make a difference, no doubt. I mean, deer are unbelievable what they have to go through. Well, all animals, what they have to go through with the heat and then the cold and the snow and freezing and get wet, and then it freezes, and, you know, they're just tough animals.
Yeah.
It never ceases to amaze you what they can suffer through a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, just being those tough conditions and getting injured from various reasons or various things and recovering from that, what seemingly shouldn't be recoverable, but they get over it and, you know, give them a little time and they're none the worse for wear. So,
well, that's one of the reasons, you know, you think about it, the adaptability of whitetails makes them so successful. You know, you've got whitetails down the Keys and got whitetails up in Canada, and they're all figuring out a way to get it done.
That's right.
I mean, I'm sure there are other, I don't want to step on my foot here. There's other critters. I mean, black bears do it to the same degree, but there's, you know, some of these critters that go, yeah, you got that environment. I can figure out a way to make a living in it.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'll make that work. Also, well, I have you on here, and I have a lot to talk about, but as so many of us are running digital trail cameras, we're watching year round, and we're watching.
Not many people running 100 like you.
I'm not running 100, Mike. That's ridiculous. Well, it's 25. 98. But as you know, as we're watching bucks this time of year and coming in, kind of where do you, like somebody who does this and watches it, where are they in general? I know everything's specific. Are they 50% done, 60% done here in August, 80% done? Is there any kind of rule of thumb for that, for growing antlers?
Yeah, like, you know, they're probably 80%+ done with antler growth. Well, probably a little less than that, but they're getting close to being done. By the end of August, you know, they'll be pushing probably 90% done, I would guess, in most places. You know, some areas it may be, you know, the further south you go in Alabama, it may be a little bit behind some of the more northern parts of the state. But yeah, they're getting probably 3/4 of the way there by this time of year, probably.
What does the science show, too? Because, you know, I think about often people down here, it's after the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo, they start to shift gears a little bit to go and start thinking hunting. They go, oh, well, you know what? I need to put out some protein supplement out there because now they're building these antlers. But it seems like a bunch of that was done months ago. Yeah. I mean, when do they like, when's the – if somebody was going to give that, or when it was most useful to a buck, when would that be?
Yeah, you want to have that done – before they actually start growing, you know, when they're making that transition from that, their metabolism and everything else shifts from that winter mode where they're storing and utilizing those fat reserves to where they're going into the recovery and growth period of spring and summer. So back in April, would have been the time to start thinking about that and have it available during that May, June, July when they're doing the bulk of the antler growth. And not only that, that's when those fetuses are developing and you get into this time of year and the fawns have been born. And so that's a big drain on or big protein need on the doe side of things. So, for the antler growth stuff, yeah, you want to start that late spring and all the way through early summer, midsummer.
Y'all hear that, co-op people? That's when right now they start putting all the bags out, right? Yeah. Instead of they should have been putting them out months ago.
But this is when the hunters start.
I know. We just got to educate ourselves to the best use.
I mean,
of that.
The best time to put it out is year round if you could possibly afford it and do it. And, you know, if you're able to plant soybeans, big clover fields, and that kind of stuff, and give them year-round protein, that, of course, is the best for the does and the bucks. But most people can't, and most people are leasing their land, and most people have small green fields. So there's just so much you can do unless you want to spend a lot of money on protein feed, and it is expensive.
Yeah, and you know, putting out the feed, again, they're typically you're not putting out enough a large enough quantity or on a large enough scale to make a difference in all the deer on the property's antler quality or anything else. Now, there's going to be some deer, of course, that probably utilize it more and may have a bigger benefit, but you say the same thing about food plots. They should be viewed as a supplement. You know, the bulk of what that deer's eating and what should be the focus, and you know, there's, like Mike said, there's all kind of things that people have to deal with from leasing or whatnot. But if you know, all things, if you don't have restrictions on what you can do to the property, and all, of course, managing the forested acres and improving that habitat to where there's high quality forage available for them throughout the year, then that feeder and food plots, they serve as a supplement to help bump up what should already be a good diet for those deer to put them over that hump to where they're growing a little bit better. But, you know, that's not the case for a big percentage of the hunters out there. They just don't have the either the acreage or the flexibility to do things like that on the property or the resources. So
yeah,
you know, putting out feed, while it may not make measurable differences in antler growth and body size and things like that, it makes people feel good. and that there's a lot to be said for that. You know, they're more, it keeps them involved with deer management outside of the hunting season, which is key to
true to
staying focused and on the track, because it can get frustrating. You know, long term, if you're not seeing immediate results, but doing things like that can keep everybody involved and keep them focused on the goal, and ultimately, hopefully they'll get there and they'll see and harvest some better quality deer, and all the struggles are forgotten then. So.
Yeah, I don't want to get sidetracked, but another problem that we have in trying to do that is hogs. You know, you're trying to put protein feed out, and it's so expensive to put out that the hogs will just find it and eat it before the deer get much out of it. So that's another issue that we run into.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, to the point where a lot of folks are fencing around their feeders, if they're using feeders, just put up a 4-foot net wire fence and just to keep the pigs out. They've been doing it in, you know, Texas and for years, and I see more people doing it here in Alabama now, because, you know, it's frustrating to go check on a feeder and it's knocked over and emptied because the hogs are moving around and broke a leg or knocked the whole thing over, but doing those little things to keep them out again is another one of those never-ending list of stuff to do when you're trying to manage the deer.
Right, and this is going to be this perfect transition, because when we come back, more with Deer Program Coordinator for the State of Alabama, Chris Cook, we're going to talk about getting this kind of advice and assistance on your particular piece of property with the DMAP program in Alabama. We'll do that when we return on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you all along. And great to have Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for the State of Alabama, on as well. And obviously we'll get him on again before deer season gets started properly.
We know Chris is the deer coordinator, but I don't want to get sidetracked again, but we might have to get the hog coordinator on here one day. Wherever he's at, if we can find him.
They were fired.
They were fired. Yeah. They did a bad job.
Wants to take that burden of having that title. So, yeah. that's a losing cause right there.
Show of hands, who wants to be the hog coordinator? No, really, I said raise y'all's hand. No one, okay.
I will give you a raise.
Yeah, no, they don't want any part of it. But, you know, mentioned this, and this came out a couple days ago, and people can check it out at outdooralabama.com and probably on a couple different websites out there. But it's a reminder here of what you and your team does in the Deer Management Assistance Program for private landowners and leaseholders in Alabama. Explain it to the uninitiated. What is DMAP?
Yeah, the Deer Management Assistance Program is a program that was first put in place back in 1984, I think, was the first year it was done in Alabama. It started out with 10 pilot clubs, and then it was expanded in 85 to everybody. And it's a program. It was free when it first started. We charged for a little while, but it's free again now. But it's a program that hunters or hunting clubs, landowners, anybody that has property that where they hunt, manage deer, they can sign up, and they're paired up with one of our biologists that can help them, you know, figure out what their realistic deer management goals are and help them do what they need to try to achieve those goals. And, you know, the basic premise is that the cooperator collects harvest data from the deer they kill. The data includes, you know, of course, buck or doe. They get a weight of the deer. If it's a buck, they measure antlers. If it's a doe, they check to see if she's lactating, if she's producing milk. But most importantly, they collect a jawbone from each of the deer so that the biologist can estimate the deer's age, because without the age, all of those other things mean nothing. You know, a 120-pound year-and-a-half-old buck is a whole lot different than a 120-pound three-year-old buck.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have all that data. Then the biologist, you know, meets with the cooperators. They again, like I mentioned earlier, they talk to them and to them, if it's a club, try to meet with the club. But if it's a landowner, get with them and to better understand exactly what do you want to do deer-wise? What are you trying to manage for? And then help them understand, all right, well, that may not be achievable, or yeah, that's definitely something that can be done. And based on the data, this is where you're at. But they also, not just, you know, looking at the deer data and the condition of the deer, making recommendations on deer harvest, but they're also available to meet on site and make recommendations on ways that the habitat could be improved, be it from, you know, burning, you know, recommendations on prescribed burn, you know, recommendations on if you're wanting to manage this timber stand for the benefit of wildlife, thinning, you know, to this stage or to this level, but you know, also with food plots. And so anything related to that, they're available to provide input on that. Each year, you know, the cooperator submits their data. The biologist uses that data plus the other information they've gathered from their discussions with the cooperator, and they make a prepare report. The report typically includes an evaluation of the data that was collected and submitted the previous season, and then it also includes recommendations for the coming season as far as harvest and anything else that they have discussed prior to the report. So it's again, it's a free program. We have five biologists that are in our technical assistance unit now, and they're basically private lands biologists, and that's who primarily will be working with folks on our deer management assistance program. They're easy to get a hold of. They're all based out of our district offices. You can find all that contact info at outdooralabama.com. Down there at Y'all's Way, Ross Jones is the local guy in District 5. He works out of our office there at Spanish Fort. But in the other districts, you know, just contact the office for whatever county your property's in where you'll need assistance. So it's a real simple program to get started with. We have, you know, back in the heyday, I think we peaked out at about 2,100 cooperators, and
wow,
which covered about 4 million acres, you know, and in the late 90s when we started making the either sex seasons a lot more liberal across the state. A lot of people got out of the program because they were, the primary reason they were in there, mm-hmm, was to get the have the flexibility to shoot more does than those handful of days that they had prior to that.
Right.
So, we're down now to about, I think we have about 130, 140 cooperators statewide now. It's a more manageable workload on our biologists, but we definitely want more people to take advantage of it and enroll, because it not only, you know, the data that the cooperator provides not only benefits them, but also benefits us. You know, we get harvest data from our WMAs, but we also really need and value that age-specific data, you know, the age structure of the harvest that we get from DMAP cooperators. So the more of that we can get, the better. It helps us with knowing what's going on, what the age structure of the harvest looks like. Yeah, the typical DMAP cooperator is probably not like most properties, but it does give you an idea of what's going on out there now. I know it's probably a typical DMAP cooperator is a lot more reflective of what's going on now than it was probably 25 years ago when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the properties that are in DMAP or that were in DMAP then were a lot more restrictive in what they were shooting than probably the average hunting club. But that has changed over the last three decades. So a lot more people are passing bucks. And so it's probably a lot closer to what's what's going on folks that aren't in BMAP than what it was back then, for sure.
But yeah,
Chris, it's definitely a good program that we want people to take advantage of. We have people there to work with you, and it's just a matter of getting in touch and getting the ball rolling.
Yeah, I think about this for the landowner or the leaser or whoever your partner is. Number one, that data coming back that y'all give us, you know, now we weighed the deer, we pulled the jawbones, but we now, and not just because Bob said that deer is 3.5 years old, now we have an actual biologist telling us whether, yeah, how old that deer was. So that helps us understand things on the land. And I got to tell you, too, people say, well, you know, back in the day, like you said, people got into it for, you know, being able to shoot does, more does.
Yeah.
But, you know, legally, you can shoot one doe.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not in DMAP. But in DMAP, if you want to, you know, get your doe shooting done.
No, one per day.
Yeah, one per day.
Yes.
You know, but if we're on DMAP, we can shoot more than one, right?
Yeah, that's something I didn't mention. That in addition to that report that cooperators get, we also provide an antlerless deer permit. We used to have tags. You know, if you've been in the program for a while, you probably remember the days when you'd get an envelope full of tags that were used that had to be attached to each doe that was killed on the property. We switched years ago to where it's just a permit. And on that permit, each property is allowed X number of antlerless deer. So say Sean's property, he gets a permit where he can kill 30 antlerless deer. The way that works is as soon as hunting season comes in, even down y'all's way where it's, you know, when bow season starts, it's bucks only, I think, the first 10 days.
That's right.
You can go ahead and start shooting does, and you can shoot up to that allotment that's on your permit. So if you've got a permit for 30, you can kill 30. Once you get to 30, you're supposed to stop. Now,
but who reach? I mean, yeah, we just got a couple minutes left. But, okay, here's a frank question. Even when people have the best intentions, how many people max out the number of does or antlerless allocated by DMAP?
It's probably not
not many.
Probably not a quarter of them.
Okay,
they get pretty close. Most of them do. There's a lot of them, and it's always been that way.
It gets hard
to get to your point with that permit. Yeah, you can shoot as many of those as you want to in a day. So if there's, you know, a lot of folks try to do this, that when gun season comes in, if they've got 30 and there's 10 of them hunting, they all, you know, maybe we can get all 30 of them killed in this weekend, and then we can let things calm down and focus on getting ready for the bucks whenever the rut rolls around. So,
that's an advantage.
You have a lot more flexibility in your doe harvest with the permit. But it's something that, and it's the same way people always talk about how we, you know, need to, or some people do, reduce the number of doe days because everybody's killing does. And like, well, not really. People, you know, the news wore off of that for the most part. You know, it used to be when you didn't have the opportunity to shoot a lot of does, yeah, if you got if the season rolls around, everybody's going to take advantage of it because it was new to them. But now, you know, we've got a whole generation that have grown up hunting, and it's always been you can shoot one or two does every day, you know, where you were at. And so it's not as new anymore. And while it sounds like, yeah, they should be killing every deer in Alabama with those seasons they got, people just don't take advantage of it. So.
That is for sure. But let's once again remind folks, if they're saying, okay, well, our hunting club or whatever wants to do this, there's still time for this year, right? They can get in?
Yeah, you can go ahead and you will go ahead. If it's something you're interested in, definitely go ahead and contact the biologist for your district, and they can get you set up with maybe try to meet with you before hunting season, also get you set up with what you'll need to collect the data this coming year. And that's always a good first step. But it's never too late to reach out and get started with participating in the program.
Well, Chris, we appreciate you, and we'll get you back on before deer season starts. Thanks for your time today.
No problem. Talk to you guys later.
All right, there he is, Chris Cook. He is the deer program coordinator for the state of Alabama. If you consider DMAP before, you can get in this year. Get it going. All right, coming right back, we'll shift gears from the woods to the water. And Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, joins us coming up next. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you all along. And always a treat to get our next guest on with us, Director of Alabama Marine Resources, the Commandant, I'll call him, Scott Bannon.
Yeah.
Good to have you on. And you know what? Happy belated Coast Guard Day to you, too. Thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed 30 years of participating in the Coast Guard, and I'm very proud to have done it, and I would sign up and do it again today.
It's good stuff. Yeah, awesome. Friday was Coast Guard Day, so good stuff there. And a lot to talk about. I want to talk about fish, but to pull back the curtain for everybody, while we're in the news break, it immediately went into a conversation not specific to fish. Mike?
Well, you know, we got to talk about other things than fish with the director. You know, I saw Scott down the other day working on the parking lot for the trailers in the boat
down,
trailers.
Down where?
You know,
down
at
where?
Dolphin Island. Okay. At Dolphin Island, working on the parking spots for the trucks and trailers. And then I saw a lot of comments on Facebook that, you know, some of them are favorable, some of them weren't favorable. And that's what we were talking about before we came on air. I want to hear it from the horse's mouth, from Scott. What do you think about it, Scott?
Well, one, you were very very kind in saying that some were positive. Probably
I saw one.
So first, I will tell you that is the project is for the town of Dolphin Island. Most of that is Dolphin Island property, and it is funded through the Gomesa funding through the governor's office to make that parking safer, more efficient. And also, we're going to add a wheelchair accessible lift to the concession stand because that's where the restrooms are. We're going to redo the wheelchair ramp on the east side of that because it is it's beyond its life expectancy. So we're going to replace that. We're going to increase the lighting down there, and ultimately, we're going to tear out the boat ramps and the boat docks and redo those to where they're top-notch. They meet the standard that we use now, and it'll be much more efficient. So in the grand scheme of things, there's lots of things going on down there. But the parking, the one challenge that we had was how do we put the most number of trucks and trailers or vehicles and trailers in that relatively small area. And so we did a lot of surveying. We did had discussions with boaters. We took trucks and trailers down there and practiced different ways. And so we opted for a pull-in style parking in order to maximize the number of people that can park without having to walk all the way down to the side of the road. And that we felt that drivers were more likely to center the parking bumper. The parking spots are 12 feet wide. And if they were to pull in as opposed to backing in. Now, there are some advantages to backing in that we realize that you gain a couple of feet when you back your tires to a parking bumper. Trailers have an average of 2 to 5 feet of board that stick out, and that would be across the parking bumper. But if you look at there are three sizes of parking spaces that we have for vessels and for trucks with trailers. And they range from 45, there's about three of them that are 45, to 55 to 60, and then the last 16 are over 80 feet deep. So there's a total of 40 trailer parking spots. We added 12 single car parking spots, redid the ferry employee parking, redid the concession parking, added an ADA trailer parking spot, which we did not have before, and created a van accessible ADA parking spot, which was not available before. The striping will come this next week for that. And so it is change, and that is difficult for folks. But we have seen people using it efficiently and effectively. And I go down there and talk to folks, and most people are very pleased with the changes.
Yeah, like we talked about before, you're not going to know till we try it. I mean, it sounds good. I know that I can pull in straighter than I can back in. So you're going to be able to put more trucks and trailers in by pulling in, you know.
And I will tell you, Mike, I've been doing this about 33 years around the water and boat ramps, and you know, maybe about a month shy of what you've been around boat ramps and things. But and I have a camera system where I watch boat ramps more than I should. Some people are going to make it work. and some people should never show up.
I want to see some of those videos, by the fact.
It actually took one person backed in the other day. It took them over 3 minutes, and they blocked all four lanes of traffic because they pulled all the way to the east side past the ferry booth, and it took them 3 minutes. It's taking most people to back out of those parking spots and pull forward about 8 seconds.
Right.
So you're not talking about a big traffic delay. And some changes that you're going to see once the striping is in place, you're going to see as you're going eastbound, your left-hand lane along the fence is going to be the ramp prep lane, and it'll have some striping and some words on the pavement that's going to say that, where you get prepared to go to the ramp. And then when you come back and you're going westbound, the drive lane will be against the fence, and it'll be a 12-foot wide lane, which is interstate width. And then you're going to have a 14-foot wide tie-down lane, which will have some hash marks in it and some words to identify it as a tie-down lane, where you can get your boat prepared to get on the road, get everything strapped down, pull the plug, and not chew up the gravel. And
awesome.
There's going to be another 4 feet of asphalt that's available for parking. So it's going to be a totally different view.
Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to it, to be honest with you. I think it's going to be great, especially when you get the striping in. You know, there may be a little bit of an issue before you get the striping in that somebody parks closer to somebody than they would if the striping
That's
was
correct.
In, you know. So that can create a little bit of an issue when you go to back out if you don't have enough room to be able to turn your tires to get your trailer turned to get on the road right. So, but I think after you get your striping in there, there shouldn't be any problems, and it should be easier for everybody. I saw on Facebook where they were complaining about you wasn't going to be able to back out. You couldn't see the cars coming and all that. Once you back out a foot or two, I can't imagine that you'd have any issue with cars running into cars or anything.
No, because you're looking over top of trailers.
That's right.
And I did tell Mayor Collier, I said, Mayor, let's get the striping in place. Let's give it some time for people to adjust and make a determination. Hey, is this something that we want to continue with long term? If not, they're pinned into gravel. We go unpin a corner, we turn them, we face them the other way. But so far, we've seen people make the adjustment. I've talked to people who've said they have no problem with it, and they're learning which spots work well for their truck and trailer. So the transition, it was a little rough at first, and I have some video to prove it, but now it's really been flowing very well. And again, once the striping's done, and we're actually going to restripe all the way from the pilot station coming from the east to west to keep the traffic away from the boat docks or boat ramps. And ultimately, when we get to redo the docks, my goal is that we have 90 feet from the water to the edge of the road for people to launch their boats.
Boy, that's going to be awesome. But I don't understand exactly how you're going to get that done. It's going to be great when you do that.
I'm a dreamer, Mike. I'm a dreamer.
Yeah, I just don't know how that works, getting the launch ramp further out in the water. But I know y'all know what you're doing. I know you can do it. But that's going to be really good to be able to pull in there and have plenty of room to back your trailer into the launch ramp.
Yes, that's the goal.
That's especially on big boats. I mean, used to, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, the big boat was a 25-foot, 28-foot. Mm-hmm. You know, now you got all these, 35, 40, 42, 44s.
We have.
You know?
Consistently, there are several 39-footers, and their truck and trailer, one of them is 74 feet from the front of his bumper to the back of his trailer.
Yeah.
And so that is about the longest one, but several of them are 72 feet.
Yeah, just the thing is to also get the word out. You've got different size parking places, and just to make it to where somebody doesn't just take it, you know, who has a smaller trailer, you know, than the person that has a bigger trailer. They got to get used to that, too. Not all spaces are the same anymore.
That's right. You know, you got a speckled trout boat that's 20, 22
people
foot.
People got to know that. I mean, there's some people who just will learn it and then do it. Then there's always going to be a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah, you might have to put a sign up there.
Hey, jerk.
Small boats, medium boats, large boats.
Or compact boat.
We actually consider that. Right now it just says vehicles with trailers and all others will be towed. So please don't pull in there if you're a car. We've added 12 single car parking spots that never existed. So,
yeah.
And they're in the shade down by Albright. So, take advantage of that.
You know, what I do when I have people that meet me at Dolphin Island, say Sean, you know, he goes fishing with me. We meet up at next to Ship and Shore right there at the little park there, and he parks there. And and I pick him up, and that way it's not taking up any space down around the launch ramp.
Yes, and that's what, again, when people use some common sense. And now we've also spread the effort. Ladner Landing is another one that Dolphin Island put in. It's down by the Circle K, the boat ramp there. It has about 30 parking spots. Become very popular for people fishing in the Sound. Or, I don't know if y'all have noticed, that the west end of Dolphin Island has now become the Robinson Island of Mobile.
Yes.
So it's been very convenient for that.
That's the only place I've launched. That's it. Well, the only place I've launched this year is you said the Ladner, or what people are calling the Aloe Bay launch. That's the only place I've done that, for inshore and offshore. I would rather go run around than deal with Billy Goat Hole. So that's what I've used. Before we're going to go to the break and come back, we'll have a few minutes afterwards. But to remind people that it's a trifecta weekend, right?
It is.
Meaning
red snapper, trigger fish, and amberjack all on the same
trip. So, yes, what we've been waiting for is here. We come back. We'll talk more about this with Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Moore, glad to have you all along. Always great to have Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, on. We talked a lot of trailers and boat launches, but we do need to throw a little fishing into the mix. As Scott, you said, I mean, this is trifecta today, tomorrow. Monday, we can fish for all three of our favorite reef species.
That's correct. And that's, as we call the trifecta, it's the one thing that we hear from the public is to have an opportunity to make a multi-species trip, because again, we understand time is valuable and we know what the price of gas is. So those three seasons do align right now in the beginning of August. So, we do remind folks that all three of those species are required to be reported in snapper check. And that if you're, if you're going on a charter boat, you still have those same three species through the end of the month as well. But there are opportunities for folks to really have some enjoyable trips, I think. And it looks like the weather is holding out. We struggled with some weather days earlier in the season. These last couple of weekends, the weather's been slick. It's been hot, though.
It's been way. Okay. So we have something concrete on in the month of August, concrete date for amberjack to end. I think, was it the 24th? Is that?
Yes, for the closing date.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, because amberjack is a fall season. August is the, quote, beginning of the season for amberjack. It's kind of weird. That came through the Gulf Council. Long story there, but that season starts in August, and then it'll close, and then it'll potentially reopen in the spring.
Okay, so there's one that we know when that's going to close. Triggerfish, do we have a date certain on its closure?
I don't believe so. I don't think on the trigger. I think we're going to get a response from NOAA on that one. And then red snapper,
we're at
515,000 pounds on the Alabama quota this previous weekend, this last Monday. So this current weekend, we are open. And looking at the effort over the last couple of weekends, there's a good chance we'll be open next weekend as well. Other than being the trifecta weekend, this is the weekend that we start school this next week.
Yep.
And once school starts, that really changes the effort. You know, people, there's so many other things drawing them away from being able to fish. So I'm encouraged that we have good weather this weekend. I'm encouraged that people get to go have a multi-species trip. And if it closes in the near future, I think we've had a good season. You know, our quota is 591,000 pounds. So, we still have I can't do that math quick in my head, but from 515 to 591. So it's pretty good.
But there's got to be a buffer, right? You can't, that's kind of the rules. You can't run it right up to the edge.
Okay. We can for this because okay. we're managing this quota. And if we go over a little bit, we do a payback next year. So we just reduce that from next year's. I don't anticipate that we'll get in that position where we'll, if we do go over, I think it'll be very, very slight. It'll be not even noticeable in the quota next year. And we're going to get another boost in our quota. We're waiting on a rule to go through Secretary of Commerce, and that'll probably come into effect for the 2024 season. There's a odd chance that it comes in late this year, but most likely it'll be next year, and that moves us up to over 600,000 pounds. So that's a much more comfortable quota for us. I think it gets us about where we need to be in Alabama to have a reasonable season where lots of people get lots of opportunities. And once we settle things out, we can look, hey, do we want to do the season a little different? You know, going 7 days a week is probably not going to move that needle a lot. I think our average Mondays right now are about 5,000 pounds. So if you added 4 days a week and made it 20 or 25,000 pounds, that's about a Friday. So, you know, gotcha. You can kind of look at it from that perspective.
So what is Louisiana? They're 7 days a week, and their quota is, or their limit is four per person.
Four fish.
So mm-hmm. Have you checked theirs to see their 7 day a week? Is it that much more?
No, it doesn't. A matter of fact, I don't think they're going to fish their quota by the end of the year because they're at about 900,000 pounds. And I think through last weekend, they were at about 35 or 40% of their quota. And they're going to run into the same challenge that we have with, school being back in. And remember, in Louisiana, red snapper fishing is generally not a targeted fishery.
It's not.
It's more of a, hey, we've been tuna fishing or we've been doing this other type fishing or maybe even trout fishing. And then you just jet out because it's really nice and you grab a couple of red snappers. So.
And on the way in from tuna fishing, they might stop and catch them a few snapper to add
yeah,
to,
absolutely.
You know, and the other thing's going to change a little bit this week and next week. Price of gas has gone up basically 50 cents a gallon.
It sure
so,
has.
I mean, for a lot of people, that's a big deal. That'll make it where they're going to go or they're not going to go.
Right. They're going to, when they're looking at where their priorities are this time of year, they're going to say, I'm out. And that's unfortunate. But we also know that they're going to go on to other outdoor activities with their children. We know that duck season will be here before we know mm-hmm. it. Deer season. You know, I think Sean's been breaking tractors pretty regular here lately. So, John Deere loves this time of year. So,
and once again, so obviously this weekend it's in. You think next weekend, probably pretty good chance, too, of it still being in?
I think a very strong possibility that next weekend. And what you can do is go to outdooralabama.com/redsnapper summary. It has the 2023 graphics. We usually post it by Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning. We've really increased the efficiency of that program. So usually about late afternoon on Tuesday, we have it published, and you can see where we are in the quota. And I promise you that I will make sure that press releases go out, Facebook notices travel far and wide when we anticipate the season's going to close.
There you go.
That's good.
It's because, we wonder, you know, we just go, where's the mechanism? People say, well, where's the mechanism to find out? And that's going to outdooralabama.com. And then obviously beyond that, just keep it up. I mean, if you're following certain pages on Facebook and all that, when that information comes out, you'll probably see it.
Yes. You'll know. You'll know. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll do this again after we have maybe another couple trips offshore and talk about it more. We got to talk some trout and some flounder and some other things as we go forward over the next couple of months. Okay.
And I'm gonna park in your parking lot tomorrow, so I'll let you know what I think about it.
Tell me how it goes.
I will.
Good stuff. Thank you to Scott Bannon, Director of Alabama Marine Resources. We're out of here as well. We'll do it again next week.